Welcome to the Finding Backcountry Podcast with your host, Dustin Whitwer.
I am Dustin Whitwer, and this is the Finding Backcountry Podcast. Follow along on my journey of learning from the best backcountry hunters each week as we explore valuable information I use to find success in the backcountry. Let's get to the show. Welcome to another episode of the Finding Backcountry Podcast. And these are starting to become pretty consistent, so that's good. I've got just a classic. You're a repeat guest, right, Henry?
I am, yeah.
I'll have to go look up what episode you're on, but, you know, I find that as I start, you know, thinking of who I want on the podcast, it's like every time I just kind of circle back to the same, like, you know, 15 people, because because we have the same interests.
I'm flattered to be on the list.
Well, we have the same interests, or, you know, I know you, or I've met you or something, and so yeah. Maybe I need to branch out a little bit. I don't know, but I'm completely fine just having the same 12 guys on talking about mule deer every episode.
I see nothing wrong with that personally. I've enjoyed all your podcasts, Dustin. So no, it's and now that you live in the land of opportunity for hunters,
that's
you're probably gonna have to.
That's Utah, if anyone's wondering.
Yeah, that's gotta be it. Yeah. The place with, let's see, 4 times the population you guys have.
Yeah.
Oh man. Well, yeah, I'm starting to see that these sparsely populated states are without a doubt the land of opportunity. Yeah. Having living in one that's got like 10 times your population in the almost exact same geographical area, it's getting ugly trying to get tags here anymore.
Yeah, you guys say that, but and if anyone's wondering who Henry Ferguson, let's sum you up in one sentence. Archery, Colorado archery mule deer guru. Did I nail it?
I know a lot of people who would argue with the guru, and myself being one of them, my wife being one of them, because it takes me longer every year to get it done. But, you know, hey, that's
hey, if you're, you know, it's, I was told once in business or what, you know, whatever principle I was researching or something, it's like, hey, if you can consider yourself an expert on something, you know, if you could teach the principle to 90% of, you know, the population or whatever. So relative to the population of the United States, you're definitely a mule deer expert. And I would definitely argue that within just people who hunt, you are you're definitely an archery expert and definitely a mule deer expert. So you can't get around that.
Well, I appreciate it. And I'll tell you, I mean, it's a passion. Both of those things are passions of mine. I mean, I've been shooting a bow since I was like 14, and it was, I just remember first time I got my own bow and went out and shot it in the backyard, just how awesome it was. You know, I mean, granted, I had to go out and bend all my arrows back straight after missing everything, but that should give you a little indication of how long I've been doing it, that I had to bend my arrows back straight. But
as you were saying that, I just realized there might be younger kids listening to this who never had to shoot aluminum arrows.
And you know what? I think you phrased that perfectly too. Had to shoot aluminum arrows, because truthfully, it was a process. And I mean, it was one of those things where it was kind of a feast or famine deal, where you were either shooting perfectly straight, brand new good arrows, or you were getting pretty good at learning how to bend those things back, you know, eyeballing down the shaft to see where the sun was hitting that top line and just trying to identify that little bend and then bending it back over the base of your thumb, you know?
Yeah. I was on the tail end of that era. When I was like first introduced to archery, you know, I remember being young, 5 or 6 or something like that. And my dad had an old, you know, at that time was like a, you know, an 8 or 10 year old Hoyt probably. And he was shooting, you know, Easton, whatever, XX75s or whatever.
Oh, heck yeah. The autumn orange or was he one of the lucky ones who got the camo?
They were camo, I think. Oh, yeah.
Man. If I see, remember I shot that. Autumn orange. And do you know why I shot autumn orange? First of all, they were a couple dollars less money, but they were also easier to find. They were easier to find after you'd missed. And that was important to me.
Well, it sounds like his experience too. I mean, he was shooting. I still remember he would put up stack 3 hay bales alongside of our house and our drive, you know, little driveway that went to our back part of our lot. Our lot was not big, but it was, you know, it was shaped relatively long rectangle. So he could shoot, you know, 40, 50 yards once, you know, if he stepped out right to the edge of the property by the street. But he had 3 hay bales, and I'm not talking like, you know, ton hay bales. I'm talking like 2-strand hay bales from our, from our alfalfa farm. Right. Like he had
one
hay bale deep. Right. And that all sounds normal to most people, you know, who don't have never shot bows maybe, but now like his arrows were stopping. I mean,
oh, absolutely. It would stop them cold.
It would stop them. Yeah. And
that's the crazy thing. I mean, people who are just getting involved in archery now, anytime I'm helping somebody out, I'm always, always really careful to mention to them just how lucky they are to be starting now. I mean, because the equipment is so freaking good. I mean, it truly is. I mean, we're in kind of the golden age of archery equipment, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, almost to the point of a plateau, don't you think?
I mean, you know what? I've argued against that for years, and now it's no longer an arguable point. It's leveling off, but truly, I mean, you know, hey, I just got a new bow this year. In fact, I just got a new bow a couple of weeks ago, so I'm still in that
honeymoon.
What me and my friends call that new bow honeymoon period, which is like the most glorious thing ever. Where every time you hit the range, no matter what you do, your target panic goes away. Everything, you know, the sun shines a little brighter, the birds chirp just a little louder, and you can't miss the friggin' target. I mean, it's money. Now, transitioning out of that honeymoon phase into like actual real life is often quite difficult, but I think we're going to be getting along just fine, me and this bow. But truthfully, the riser technology, and I got the Hoyt RX5 Ultra.
That's the same bow on order.
Yeah, and I either ordered mine a little sooner than you, or they liked me a little better. I don't know. It's hard to say. It's really hard to say. Or I ordered the right pattern, and that seems to be what it is. So,
is yours a 70 pound?
It is. Yeah. 70. So you, I heard you ordered an 80 pound.
I ordered an 80.
You might be waiting a little longer.
Yeah. But I heard those are backed up too. So
I will tell you this, that new cam system is amazing. It's so freaking smooth. I have shoulder problems, and I'll bet I could shoot that bow at 80 pounds.
Yeah. No, it sold me, man. I walked through, I was in Shields in Billings, and I was not planning on buying a new bow this year. I've been shooting that Traverse. I like it. I don't love it, but I also was just like, you know, there hadn't been anything that I'd seen or shot that was really, you know, that much more groundbreaking. I did miss shooting an 80 pound bow. That's just, you know, because I can, I just, I can. And man, when you match up an 80, an 80-pound bow with a 31-inch draw with a 550 to 575 grain arrow.
Man, you truly do work at a gun company.
Yeah.
My gosh.
Yeah, and
that's
so
crazy.
But I walked through there and I'm like, oh, the new Hoyt, you know, the RX5, whatever. And they had an Ultra there, and I'm like, yeah, what the heck, man? Like, my wife was downstairs shopping or something.
Take a shot. Yeah.
Sure.
What's the worst that could happen?
What's the worst?
Just one shot, right?
Exactly. Yep. And so they looked bored in the shop there. So I'm like, hey, you guys set this up, you know, whatever draw it was at, 30 or something. And so step in. I worked in a bow shop. I've been around bows, especially carbon bows. There's always been a little stigma, you know, they're just a little violent in the hand. I don't think, you know, now full disclosure, I have not shot, some of the other, you know, I think PSE has a carbon bow and, but I, anyway,
so I haven't shot that one in a while either. Right. I shot one of their first gen bows and it was violent.
Right.
But I'm sure they've improved on that.
Yeah, pretty common of the carbon bows there for quite a few years. They were just relatively, mm-hmm. you know, it was a nice touch. They're lighter and maybe, you know, a little better for late season hunts or whatever, but never as smooth long story short, I shot that bow and I just like turned. I'm like, this isn't 70 pounds. I had to check the limbs and I'm like,
I know it.
Holy cow,
I did
man.
The exact same thing. And the crazy thing is, the thing that really blew me away, I feel like the shorter version of that bow, the short RX5, if I didn't want a little bit longer bow this year, because I've shot a short bow for a number of years, that was even smoother.
Really?
As far as draw, I literally had to go put that bow on the scale. And I said, guys, there's no way this is a 70-pound bow. And I mean, I've shot enough bows over the years and I know better than to get duped by, you know, a smooth drawn bow. But I went over there and put it on the scale and it was 71.5 pounds. Mm. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was really surprising that's the kind of things, you know, we talked about things kind of plateauing. So now you're looking at refinements of an existing product. And truly, those refinements, in my opinion, are enough to make most people buy a new bow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all they've really got. You know, years ago, it felt like, you know, every year was a 20% increase in performance or efficiency or whatever. Like, you know,
yeah.
Some of those bows, you know, from year to year was just like, holy cow, this is a big deal. And
just radically different.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And now it's just like, oh, it's, you know, it feels, you know, a 3% change is a big deal, you know, or a 5% change or whatever. But
yeah. And, you know, the interesting thing is if you look at it and you go back to, you know, you go to how this applies to your hunt. And say you've got a buck that's getting ready to stand up, or he stood up a little quicker than you thought he would. And he's kind of feeding in your direction, not necessarily looking at you, but you know there's a pretty good chance of getting spotted if you have to sky draw your bow. Well, being able to pull that thing straight back to your anchor because it's nice and smooth the whole way in, that's where those things matter. You know what I mean? You hear a lot of people who kind of trash on the new bows. Oh, that's not enough different. Well, okay. Number one, this is what I do. This is my hobby. I don't mean to go all Jason Carter on this from 3 years ago, but I don't have a boat. You know, I don't have, I mean, I'm not water skiing. I mean, this is what I do. This is where I spend my money. And I mean, I want the latest. And having said that, I do get a new bow every year. And for the last, let's see, 18, 19, and 20, I hunted with the same bow. And it was just kind of funny because that bow, just for one reason or another, I'd get a new bow every year. And then I'd get down close to hunting season and I'd whip Old Faithful out. And all of a sudden, that bow just couldn't miss. And it was, you know, every once in a while you find a bow that just works with,
yes,
no matter what. And it just, It just fits you like a glove, and that's what I had. And I think I've got another one here in this new one. So
that's really so. You know, I was a guy who bought a new bow every year. I mean, for a few years there, I worked at a shop, so you're obviously going to get a new bow every year. But even, you know, before that and after that a little bit, you know, and you're right. You know, you go down that rabbit hole of, man, I'm just going to upgrade my bow every year, no matter what. Right. Well, I finally, I finally kind of gave that up and I said, you know what, like, I'm going to find a bow and I'm going to stick with it. And I'm not just going to upgrade, right? And I shot that Trevor for 2 years instead of 1 year, right? Now, what I'll say, though, is over the, you know, yeah, the micro differences that you're talking about on just how a bow feels from year to year are man, it's got to be your passion, like you said. It's got to be your thing to almost even pick up on them, right? Like, I remember in the shop, like, we would sit there when the new bows came in, and you would take the previous year model that you've been selling for, you know, 6 or 8, 10 months, whatever, and you would shoot it next to and almost have to blindfold yourself. And we were just picking out the slightest subtleties of, like, oh, yeah, there is.
The interesting thing would be that blindfolded test.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean,
just the slightest.
You would know then.
Yeah. Well, and so what I was going to say, though, is over the course of, oh, man, how long have I been shooting bows now? You know, 20 years I've been, you know, off and on. Now I rifle hunt now, too, but I've been shooting.
Do you count the couple of years when you were all about that trad life as still shooting a bow?
Yeah. I still
you
had
that in there. Okay. Well, no, I just wanted to make sure we're on the same page. So.
I didn't have, if anything, it made me appreciate compounds even more.
I bet it did. Honestly. I mean, hey, the difference between needing to sneak into 40, 50, 60 yards and the difference of, you know, needing to be, you know, stick bow close is there's a significant difference there. Yeah. I'll tell you what, I've had a lot of stocks blow up because I got too close that had I been able to set up at like 40 yards, I think I would have been totally fine. Yeah. I think I would have gotten away with the movement that blew it for me, you know?
Yeah. But anyway, over the last, you know, 20 years of shooting bows, what you do realize, or what I've realized, and I'm curious if you've found the same thing, because you kind of hinted at it, is there is a difference between a bow that feels good in your hand at the shop or just, you know, just feels good just putting a few arrows through it initially, and then a bow that shoots well for you. Does that make sense? Like, and you,
oh, that
you,
makes perfect
right
sense.
You find some of those, and it's not always, I don't know, it's not always the bow that feels the best or balances the best or whatever, and it's like, man, but this one, like, when I picked up that bow, like, I just was gonna shoot lights out, you know. And like that Traverse was a perfect example. I'm not affiliated with any bow company, by the way. Like, I was shooting at Matthews last year, I'm shooting a Hoyt this year, so I don't really care, and I'll talk candidly, but like, that bow felt so good in the shop. It felt the best. I did my due diligence 2 years ago. I went through, I shot every single bow within reason on the market that the local pro shop had. And that was hands down the best feeling bow, you know, on the shot, on the draw, on the release, everything. I just never shot it that well compared to other bows that I've shot well in my life. I don't know. Is there a difference there from a guy?
You know what? It makes more sense than you think. And I'll tell you, here's why. When you sit there at the shop and you're shooting a bow, you're shooting a bare bow. I mean, you know, it's got a rest on it.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it. And I've been talking to some of the shops here lately about trying to set up, you know, trying to put fully set up bows on their shelves. Because I think it'll help them to avoid the guys who come in and say, okay, just transfer all my old accessories over to my new bow.
Sure.
But, well, unless they're like me and they're total creatures of habit and they're stuck in that. But the fact is, they said, you know, most of the bows that go out of the shops here, you know, go out with one of two rests. maybe three rests, you know, a couple different stabilizer combos. But when you're shooting a bare bow, you're shooting and you're judging it based on, most people are judging it based on how much, you know, recoil there is in the shot. So how smooth that is, how smooth it draws. And, but one thing that most people struggle with is really telling how that thing feels at full draw. How stable does it feel on the target? How, you know, and so that's where it, truthfully, Matthews has owned the shop lately because their bows feel so freaking smooth.
They do. They excel on the hand. Yeah, they excel on the hand shock, and they excel on the relatively smooth draw cycle, especially when they had their solo cams, right? Like,
well, and now that new concentric cam system in theirs, I mean, that, dude, that thing is butter smooth. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, I'm under no illusions, and I've shot Matthews for, I shot him several times over the years. But, you know, they require a different weighting system on stabilizers to get the bows to aim right for me. And that's, but you look at most people, they add quite a bit of stabilizer weight to those bows. And I don't shoot a real heavy bow particularly well. That's just my own style. When I get a lot of mass weight on that front end, I tend to, my bow shoulder tends to kind of creep up on me, and that's where my shot just goes to crap. So
it's interesting, man, just the difference between having a bow that feels, quote unquote, feels good, and a bow that shoots good. And they're not they haven't always been the same thing.
Yeah, they're not always the same thing.
Yeah,
but
you know,
yeah,
I'm glad that you brought up Carter a minute ago, because I have some an order of business to take care of. For the record, if anyone's looked at a Ultra Fiesta, it's like the blue, light blue.
That is so a llama.
It is so a llama, right?
That is absolutely a llama. Now, now that I have the llama expert on the phone, I do need to ask you a question.
Yeah, fire away.
Okay, so this is coming from somebody who failed freshman Spanish. So just so we know exactly where everything sits here before we start.
Yo también.
You lost me at C. Right after C. You had me at C and you lost me after that. So here's a question. Is it llama or is it llama? Because two L's in Spanish is, you know, that's a Y sound.
You got the wrong Whitwer brother llama expert on the horn here, because the other one is the one you're after, and he served a mission for our church in a Spanish speaking country, and so.
You know what? I might have to message him and ask him, because I think he would probably default to llama.
Sí. Jason entiende. Yo no entiende nada.
Smothered burrito. That's exactly my Spanish. So
that's exactly what I said. Yep. But no, this. So I wanted to crack this open. Assuming that Carter's listening to this, and the whole Epic team for that matter,
you have to assume they are.
I have to assume that they are. And so it's always, let's just say that, I'm going to crack a llama monster open in their ear. Oh, and that just happened. Oh, so
there it is.
That just happened. But if that's
your
not
day, probably just got a little bit better, I'm guessing.
Yeah, it really did. And that, I mean, it is a vicious looking llama on the monster can, but, you know, let's put it to a vote. Anyone who, sends us a picture, you know what? I'll up Annie here. Anyone who sends us screenshots a picture of the Ultra Fiesta monster and tags the Finding Backcountry podcast and Jason Carter, Jason_Muley_Carter, whatever he's calling himself nowadays. And
I believe that's it. Yeah. Okay.
And the Epic Hunts Instagram page. I'll take all of those entries and I know the guys at Mountain Ops pretty well, but I can get them to throw something in. Isn't that ironic? I'm drinking a Monster, and then I'm like, oh, let's throw in some healthy supplements after you've drinking your Monster.
That's perfect.
Yeah,
that is perfect.
That's perfect. No, if it's not Mountain Ops, we'll throw something. I'll figure something out. But yeah, snap a photo of that. Put it on the Instagram, on your story or whatever. Tag the Epic guys, tag Carter, and let's make it clear once for all, that is a llama. That's the llama that you want packing your deer out. Like, that's a fire breathing, like, that thing looks like it could pack 200 pounds llama.
So, you know, I just find it interesting that, I mean, he's even questioning your expertise on this. I mean, well, you're a llama / llama guy. I mean, that's what you guys do. You have a business based around it.
Well, and that's,
you know,
never...
I mean, you're not questioning his knowledge on, you know, drawing 40 tags a year. Well, I mean, maybe I'm talking to the wrong guy here. You know, I mean,
it would be like me telling him how to run his trail cameras, or that trail cameras don't help you kill big bucks or whatever, right? Like, the argument's exactly. Never been that we're the llama experts. It really crossed the line when they wouldn't admit openly that llamas help you. Nay, llamas guarantee that you will kill massive deer. Boone and Crockett, Pope and Young size deer. And
okay,
really,
now the conversation just went somewhere else here. So I need to write this down. Guarantee Pope and Young and Boone and Crockett deer. Okay. That's what I needed to know.
If you're using a backcountry logistics llama.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that goes without saying. It has to be the right llama. Yeah. It's not just any llama. Some other guy, right? Llama. And well, I mean, what good's that going
to
do?
I would, in all seriousness, I would challenge someone to find a bigger deer that's been killed using llamas than your good buddy, the Gordon buck, Justin Gordon's buck, down in your neck of the woods somewhere there in Colorado. And guess whose llamas he was using when he killed the...
I mean, I don't even think it needs to be asked.
Right.
I don't need to answer that question. Yeah. well, there you go.
Speaking of that, what's your consensus of the state of Colorado mule deer at the moment?
It's not great. I'm not going to lie. I mean, we've had a couple rough years. I've been trying to write it off as weather related because last year we were in just a horrible, horrible drought. And I watch a lot of deer. I don't know if anybody knows that about me. I kind of like them, and I watch a lot of deer. And so when you watch a lot of deer, you get to know certain deer from year to year. And when you see a buck that's growing, 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 and then he just tanks. Well, there's got to be something there. And I'm not a biologist. I don't claim to be, but there has to be something that goes along with, you know, all of this. I mean, it just doesn't, there has to be a logical explanation of why a deer, like the deer I shot last year, I mean, he was a great deer. Honestly, the best deer I found all season that I could hunt. And I mean, I scouted my butt off, and that was the biggest deer I found. And he grossed 182.
Were you still seeing the same general numbers of deer? You just feel like the quality of them was down?
Well, now that's maybe bringing up another, I mean, our particular area that I hunt the most, I am seeing a decrease in bucks there. It's not significant, but I truly believe that people are getting better at hunting deer, and people are just better at hunting, period. I mean, the guys who are out there, it used to be 10 years ago, we'd go out there, and I mean, we were the most hardcore guys on the mountain, and that was what led us to success more often than not, was just the fact that we were putting in more time, more hours. And I mean, that's just not as much the case as it once was. You know, I used to go to the archery range on a bad weather day, and it was just me. Well, I went to the archery range the other day, the day after I got my new bow, and I just had to go shoot it outside. Mm-hmm. And I had a little window of opportunity that opened in my work day. And I'm like, I am taking my lunch break at the archery range. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, I've got one that's 10 minutes from my house. So I went hauling butt over there. And I'm like, man, it's pretty cloudy. That's a little breezy. And by the time I got to the archery range, 10 minutes away, it was snowing. I'm like, okay, this isn't so bad. But I got to the archery range in a snowstorm, which turned into a blizzard within like 15 minutes. There were 7 cars in the parking lot.
Midday.
And I'm like, this is midday. Yeah. And I mean, honestly, that's cool. That's really cool. I love seeing that. I love seeing people taking archery more seriously because for years, you know, hey, there's been, what's the biggest argument against archery hunting? What's the biggest argument you hear against archery hunting from rifle hunters?
Wounding or long range.
All you do is wound animals. Yeah. Well, you know what? These guys being out there in March and, you know, getting their reps in March in the middle of a freaking blizzard. Well, hopefully that helps. Hopefully that helps us out with that. It's kind of cool to see that, but on the other side of the coin,
yeah, it's like the hunter's conundrum, right? It's like
we
all love to see more, and we're excited, and we're trying to get other people into it
until they show up in our spot.
The part that no one wants to admit or talk about is we really couldn't, like, we could care less for them to show up at our hunting spot or on our same mountain or even in our state, you know, or whatever,
yeah.
You know, but we want them and we need the money. And, you know, I kind of got into this with Robbie and it's like, man, he's right. Like we need the hunter recruitment, but we hate it, but we really want it. And, but we don't want to see them there, you know, and it's tough, and man. It's tough.
It truly is. It truly is. And I think you nailed it. I mean, it is a conundrum. I mean, there's got to be balance in this, but truthfully, it's just getting harder. You know, like I said, Colorado versus Wyoming, we give out a lot of tags to non-residents, but I'll tell you what,
not as much.
It's getting harder for everybody to draw a tag.
So,
it just is.
So with that, do you think there should be more restrictions put in place on equipment, whether it's distances that you can shoot at a deer with your bow, whether it's, you know, number of pins you can run out to on your sight, whether it's
so that's easy.
or your tape, or like, you know, it, like, or and or I know you're not a long range hunter with a rifle, but, you know, should there be restrictions on long range rifle shooting to not necessarily the ethics of, you know, is it ethical or not, but do we need to limit the success rates because, you know, we feel like there's more people out in the hills, and like how this topic started is like, you know, more people being more successful. Like, do we need to limit that? Do we need to cut back tags and let people be as successful as they can be? Like, what's the answer?
And see, that's where, truthfully, you know, all of these parks and wildlife and national resource officers and all around the West are truly struggling with that right now, because it's unenforceable. First of all, you can tell somebody, hey, look, you can't have a turret on your rifle anymore. Okay. Or you can't have a single pin sight. You can't have a slider sight that goes past 60 yards. Okay, great. Well, the problem is we all know the equipment is capable of it now. I mean, everybody knows that. And what's going to happen is you're just going to have people who are going to go back to the old, you know, holdover method of yeah. missing and wounding animals. And truthfully, that's not what we want. That's not what we need by any means. So that's a tough balancing act, but really, I don't know the answer to it. I truly don't.
I'll say this. I am more ethical, and I'll challenge this with anybody. I am more ethical with my long range shooting training and my long range expertise and the equipment that I have. That is, I mean, some of the best stuff on the planet to shoot you know, an animal out to, I've shot something as far as 860 yards. I've shot something at 800, 550. I would say I am 10 times more deadly and more ethical, quote unquote, than when we were kids. Okay. Growing up doing what you were saying, we had a 3-9 loophole scope mounted on a gun that was zeroed at, you know, we didn't even really understand where, you know, it was zeroed an inch high at 100. Because why? Because I don't know. That's what Grandpa Whitworth told us to do.
That's what everybody did. Yeah.
We weren't really zeroed at any distance. We were an inch high at 100, which means we were just a little low at 200, which means, you know, whatever. And then the extent of our, you know, and by all means, tell me if this isn't how everyone else, you know, grew up doing it, is you would go out and you would, oh, we drop 12 inches, you know, at 400 yards, or we drop, you know, 7 inches at 300 yards, or whatever the ballistics were with your caliber, you know. And then if you saw a buck at 450, you were definitely going to send one because it was the biggest buck you've ever seen. And so you were doing Kentucky windage and you're holding over and praying, you know, spray and pray. You didn't understand bubble levels. You didn't understand wind for sure. You didn't even really understand, you know, maybe that's a big bodied mule deer because you're hunting up north. And so he looks bigger. And so you're holding way higher than you should be. Or maybe you're
hunting down. Well, you didn't have a range finder to begin with.
So you had a range finder if you're lucky. Yeah. And yet everyone's grandpa did that and everyone's dad and probably a lot of the guys. And that was okay. That's completely fine. That's completely fine. Put the crosshair on top of his back, you know. I'm a lot more deadly at 600 yards than I ever was at 300 yards now. So,
yeah,
you know, it's, what does that mean?
No question.
What does that mean? I don't know, but it's, you know, relative to guns or archery or anything, you know, like you said, it's so hard because there are so many different circumstances. One person, you know, might be completely ethical shooting a deer with their bow at 90 yards because, you know, they just put
because
in that
they,
much time.
It's their lifestyle, it's their passion. But, you know, and the interesting thing is I have found myself over the years, I mean, my shot distance is way shorter than it used to be. I mean, I'll be the first to admit I've shot some deer at, we'll just call it extended distances. But I mean, my kill ratio at those was phenomenal. And I mean, I've had more go wrong in close range shots than I have on long range shots. But the fact is, as myself as a hunter, myself as a person, my shots are getting shorter over the years. And that could be due to a number of things. I mean, first of all, I've
better
spent
hunter.
More time in the field. Yeah. I'm a better hunter. I'm you know, a better stalker. And that's resulted in closer shots, which is great. But again, you know, you've got to be, we all have our own ethics. We all have our own things that we subscribe to. And, you know, whether it's, you know, high FOC, heavy, you know, arrows and, you know, single bevel broadheads. And that's, you know, that's the only way, whether, you know, it's the Ashby followers or the speed freaks or, you know, those who are somewhere in between. But we all have our own set of rules that we kind of live our lives by. And there's not really a wrong way to do it, but what we need to do is we just need to be consistent. We need to be honest with ourselves. And the only way we can do that is by putting in a ton of time at the range, whether it's with your long range rifle or with your short range bow or your mid range bow. You've got to know your weapon and you have to know what your limitations are.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm not deadly with my long range gun because I have it. I'm deadly with it because I understand it and I use it, and I'm shooting with it all summer. I mean, it's my job.
Yeah,
right? Like
literally. Yeah, and it's interesting because I look at, you know, it used to be at the archery ranges here around town, the 100-yard target would get replaced every 3 or 4 years. And that was mostly because the sun had rotted it out because of our elevation. And now, man, they're replacing every target at every distance. And I think it's kind of cool because, first of all, it shows me that people are putting in the work. And that's what, again, that's what matters the most. But as far as how it's affecting success rates, It's interesting because you look at the success rates and they really haven't changed a lot.
Yeah.
You know, archery hunters, you still have the same, you know, the same few people who drive that percentage all the way up to, you know, 15 to 20% success rates. And you've got the same, you know, that group of 85%, let's call it, you know, if that's 15% that are successful, you've still got that 85%. That group changes a lot. That group's constantly in flux because people get frustrated because, man, I've done this for 5 years. It's stupid. I still haven't killed anything. Yeah. Well, hey, join the club, man. I've said it before. I could probably wallpaper the biggest wall in my office with unfilled tags from, you know, me trying to figure out how to finally do this. And, you know, it was just my stubbornness and unwillingness to quit that got me to being successful.
I went on a 7 year, I think it was a 7 year drought of not killing a buck after killing my first three deer with a bow or like forked horns, you know? And I finally, I was like, okay, from here on out, I was going to hold out for a Pope and Young 145 inch, you know, 4 point or whatever.
Yeah.
7 year drought, never killed a deer.
And think of all the, and not that there's anything wrong with that, because again, you know, we all have our own standards and we're holding ourselves to, but think of all the opportunities you robbed yourself of, that you shorted yourself of, that you could have, you know, shooting maybe 125 inch buck, that, you know, think of the lesson you learn on that stock. And that's why I am fully in favor of people taking what they want. You know, I mean, my son, his first deer hunt, we're talking about it in the days leading up to the hunt. He's like, yeah, I'd be happy with, you know, any 4 point or maybe a big 3 point. I'm like, dude, this is your first deer hunt. I'm going to unleash fury, you know, if you're not letting it go on a forky. But, you know, it was an area we'd never been to. I mean, we've never hunted it. As it turns out, things worked out our way. He got a nice 4 point, but I almost wish he would, you know, we would have had a little harder hunt and he would have ended up with a hard fought, you know, a hard won forky at the end of it. But, you know, cause I think we all have those steps we need to kind of go through and check off. But
you had mentioned your shot distances have gotten closer. One question I wanted to ask you about that. Have you noticed that since your shot distances have gotten closer, that deer bucks are more likely to react or jump your string at the closer distances?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's interesting because you always hear about, you always hear so much about whitetails jumping the string, and you don't really hear about mule deer jumping the string. And I think part of that is because a lot of people are shooting younger bucks that just don't have that life experience. But man, I'll tell you this, I have personally with my own eyes seen two bucks jump the string on me, my buck last year and a buck in 2018 that both aggressively jumped the string. And those were, you know, one of them was at 40 yards. So, but he was just a little bit jacked up anyway. I probably should have waited on that, but I had stalked this buck a couple times and, you know, kind of in the heat of the moment, I'm like, you know what? I got this shot. I feel good about this. And I did, I still feel confident that, you know, that was the shot, but he took a step. And then another, a big one that I hunted in 2018, I was at 27 yards, I think it was 25, 27, something like that. And he jumped the string hard. I mean, he dropped to load his legs to take off and run. And when he dropped, that arrow went straight through his friggin' back straps. So
yeah, I had
seen it happen. Yeah. Seen it happen a lot more at close range. And I've never had one move on my longer range shots. But
well, and to be honest, I haven't spent a ton of time, you know, inside of 40 yards actually with a bow in my hand and a tag hunting deer. Let's just be honest, most of us haven't, you know. But that came up from, it was really interesting. A guy who has spent a lot of time, and that's Randy Ulmer, was on, was it the Hoyt podcast, I think, with Alan?
Yep, Alan Hoyt. I heard that one.
Yeah. And it never really registered until he brought it up that, you know, Randy kept saying, man, the biggest problem that I have that I haven't figured out is bucks dropping strings, bucks dropping strings. And Alan's advice, surprisingly, you know, because Randy had mentioned that he won't shoot past, I think, 60 yards.
60 yards, yep.
And he won't shoot closer than 40. So he's in this range, this 40 to 60, right?
Well, he's kind of painting himself, and far be it from me to you know, argue with how Randy Ulmer goes about killing deer bigger than me every freaking year. So I want that right off the top. But, you know, truthfully, he's painting himself into a pretty small corner there just by, you know, limiting where he will and won't take those shots.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was kind of the advice is like, man, of all people, Randy, like, do you feel comfortable, you know, putting what, you know, it's kind of like, what's your group size at 70, you know? And it's like, well, he's like, I can put him in a softball every single time. You know, we all know that he could, he's professional.
Absolutely.
Basically, you know, and
you could add 30 yards to that and he's still going to put him in a softball.
Right. Right. And so it was kind of like, you know, you might want to think about letting one fly at 75 because they're less jumpy. They're less tuned up, man. I'll tell you what, things just unravel quickly, you know, when you're inside that. There's like the red zone and then there's like the ultra red zone, you know, and when you're inside
like
that,
like the
60,
no-go zone,
yeah, when you're inside 40 yeah. 50 60 yards, man, when something goes, you know, when something isn't right, those by they just come absolutely unglued.
No doubt about it.
You know, they can hear something at 100 yards or 78 yards or 89 yards, and that's just an indicator to turn and look almost. They don't assume, you know, a cat's not going to jump on them from 89 yards, right?
Yeah.
They're going to see it coming. But a cat will jump on them, you know, from 18 yards, you know, or whatever. One, you know, a cat can make one leap and bound, you know, from 42, you know, and, you know, a split second be on top of them. And so it's just, I think it's just a different tuned up level of tuned up for him there. But
yeah, I completely agree. And that's why, that's the biggest reason why, like I said, I want, and I'd love to be 50 yards away when that buck stands out of his bed and stretches. I mean, cause I'm, first of all, I'm supremely confident that I can make that shot because I've put in my practice time and I know my bow. And also, I know there's a much greater chance of that buck standing still and taking the arrow.
Where do you fall with your quietness on your bow? What are some what's the trade-off there? Are you trying to hit a certain velo? Are you trying to hit a certain grain of arrow to hit a certain velo? Are you adding string dampeners?
You know, a little bit of all that, but I mean, first of all, I mean, I shot 3D archery for a long time, and we shot 285 was like our, you know, that's where we set up our bow speed.
Why?
Found we could, well, number one, 288 was the max, and I went to a tournament once, and the 21st target was a chronograph, and I'd set my bow up in Colorado at 5,000 feet, and that bow was shooting 282, no problem. Or no, I was shooting 285 at that one. I was shooting 285, but I got down to Arizona and was shooting in Flagstaff at like 8,500 feet, and I shot through that chronograph. Keep in mind, 288 and over, thanks for coming, have a nice day, DQ. But you're disqualified. I shot through that freaking chronograph at 287.9. And I have never felt more stressed. I mean, at a tournament, I'm like, oh my gosh, because I just shot a great round. But almost threw my scorecard out the window. But I know what my bow does at that distance, at that trajectory. So it's just kind of a number that I'm comfortable with. And I've also found that even shooting a mechanical, you can get some tuning issues once you get over that 300 range. So anywhere from 280 to like 290, 295. So that's where I try to stay. Again, knowing that trajectory, or I was going to say ballistics, but I don't think ballistics apply to arrows. while I'm doing that, I'm trying to make sure that bow's as quiet as possible. And I had all kinds of weird things that contributed to me shooting that buck, the back straps in 2018. It's something I have obsessed over, maybe not a daily basis, since I'm getting more towards like weekly base now, but it was hourly for probably that first year. You work hard all summer, you pattern a buck, you figure them out, you get in there, you make your stock, everything's going great. You bump a previously unseen buck, all of a sudden everything's at high alert. So that's the conditions I got that shot at. And he moved on me.
What is your aiming point? Are you golden triangle, like right at the intersection of that kind of crease, you know, halfway up the body, or I tried lower third?
So this one was I try to aim top of the lower third, which is, the difference between aim and top of the lower third and midway in the body is just about the same. But those lungs are big, and I've found that since I stopped shooting for the heart, I started hitting more lungs. And it's just there's a little bit greater area forgiveness. But and this, I don't know, in my experience has kind of led me to this. I try to put that arrow about 2-3 inches back from the shoulder. I don't like what can happen at the shoulder. I want to have two holes in that animal for laying blood out. And I've found that I'm way more successful with that when I simply take that time and put that about 2-3 inches by the shoulder.
Gotcha.
And I'll tell you what, on elk, I'll put it 6 inches behind the shoulder. Because again, there's a lot of lung back there, and I don't want to subject myself to hitting an elk in the shoulder. I've trapped some elk that were hitting the shoulder, and those elk usually live. That's our experience on it. So I try to stay away from it.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier the different shooting at different elevations. This is something I'm not sure gets talked about a lot or enough, but what changes can happen with an arrow? I know what can happen with ballistics on a bullet, right? Going from 5,000 to 10,000 feet is very, mm-hmm. can be very significant. What changes can happen on an arrow? Let's say, like me, we used to shoot, where I grew up was 1500 feet. And then we would end up, hunting mule deer in Colorado at 12,000 feet or whatever.
It can be significant. Honestly, something that you need to, a lot of it depends on the trajectory your arrow is going to fly to begin with. If you're shooting a real slow arrow, that can be a little bit more dramatic impact. At that speed that I'm shooting, I will still make adjustments going from where I live at 6,000 feet, just under 6,000 feet to if I'm hunting up in the high country. Hunting at 8,000 feet, I don't need to adjust it. I'm simply moving my indicator pin. And what I will do is I'll get out to where I'm going to be hunting, and I always make sure I am sighting in at that distance. So if I make changes to that bow, I will make changes to that bow.
But your
because
tape,
I know
you only have one tape and it's already calibrated.
Yeah, so the tape should be good. What I find I need to do is I'll take a couple yards off the sight. So for example, if I'm shooting that bow and I want to see what it's doing at 30 yards and 80 yards. That's what I'll do is I'll shoot those two distances, and I'll, is it 20 yards?
Yeah.
20 yards almost doesn't matter. I mean, you can, nothing really affects your close range pin. So I'll shoot 30 yards and I'll find that if I'm usually hitting center of the dot, I'll usually be hitting the top end of the dot. And then I'll go back to 80 yards. And if I'm still aiming at that dot, I'm typically hitting about, and I say two to 3 yards high. So according to my sight, if I move that up, that would mean if I move my sight from 80 yards to 77 yards, that's where I'm hitting the target. So if I move that indicator pin up to 77 and then go back and shoot at 30, I'm still right on the money.
Yeah.
And that's the way I account for it. And I mean, there may be a better way. I'm sure somebody, in fact, a guy like Randy Ulmer probably has a whole spreadsheet about, you know, the ways that I'm making mistakes on that, but that's what's worked for me over the years.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, Randy Ulmer, he's switching. He's on a 12-day hunt. Apparently, he's switching between 12 different pairs of shoes that he hunts in. So,
yeah, we live in different worlds.
We live in a completely different world.
I use the same boots.
I'm over here listening to that, and I'm like, I've gone on 10-day backpack hunts with one pair of underwear, you know, like,
yeah, that's a little more hardcore than I'm willing to go, but truly, I mean, there is wisdom in what he's saying. I mean, there really is. I mean, there's definitely logic behind that, but boy, it's still a little tough for me to digest.
I will never question Randy Ulmer on archery for the rest of my life, but the shoe thing, I might question him just a little bit. And I get, you know, he's not saying that he's going to beat the wind, but he's arguing, or he's betting against the fact that, you know, if he gets in a situation where the wind swirls, he wants every advantage in his side, you know?
And I totally see the wisdom in that. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you're in a, you know, he's obviously not backpack hunting. I assume, you know, he's not backpacking in 12 pairs of shoes, maybe.
Well, no, I think he said that he has a sprinter van that he kind of bases out of.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and hey, like I said, that's a, you know, if you have that ability, that's awesome. I can totally see the wisdom in it, but it's not something that I do, you know, personally.
Yeah. But, well, what else? What are your plans this year? What do you got? Obviously you're going to hunt mule deer in Colorado. That's a given.
Well, that's my hope. Yeah. No, I should have my tag this year. I'm not, every other year I strip about it. This year I'm good. I should be good. I'm definitely worried about my wife and son drawing deer tags, because I think with Colorado kind of losing its mind a little bit on mule deer management, those rifle tags are going to be freaking hard. I'll say this, we didn't apply for more season tags. We applied second season tags because I feel like I can get in there and have a little better chance of drawing those, because everybody's going to go for those later season dates.
You know, what's going to be funny is when like the four season tags go at a super discount, because everyone's like, oh, I'm not going after four season. And everyone's I'm good.
Yeah. I don't think everybody's going to go contrarian on that. I think most people, and if there's one good thing comes out of this, and this would be a maximum of one good thing that could come out of this, because I feel that this will be potentially devastating for our deer population and our buck population, buck to doe ratios especially. But if there's one good thing that can come out of it, is that hopefully we drain the pool of these high point guys. Yeah. Because we need that. We need to get back to reality and get these guys who are hoarding 25 points for deer out of the way, because Dustin, you and I talked the other day, and I mean, they should have shot 10 or 12 bucks in that period. I mean, even if you're hunting in an area that you can draw every other year, I mean, man, the knowledge you gain from actually hunting is, in my opinion, equally valuable, if not more valuable, than having the best tag in the state or in the country, you know. And I mean, I don't know. I've never, but then again, this is coming from a guy who's never really had a primo tag. I just haven't. I just,
well,
scout more and go out and find them.
Completely agree with you. There's so many other ways that you could purge those points from guys. For example, let's just simply start with allowing Colorado people to point pool, right? You can't point pool at the moment, right?
Nope. Yeah. Nope, can't.
That right there, you know, if I had a buddy with 25 points and he's not really sure what to do, or, you know, I've had a few guys reach out and they're smart enough a long time ago to start building points, but they don't maybe live out here, or they don't quite understand the draw systems or where to apply or something like that. And so, you know, we're good friends and they might hit a guy like me up and be like, hey man, like, you know, I've got 10 points, you've got one, the unit that, you know, you're saying to draw only takes, you know, four, why don't we team up? You know, you can kind of come with me, I'll let you point boost or whatever.
Well, and one of the things that I've heard about, that one of the reasons they don't want to do that is you could, I mean, for example, man, I would have friends out here every single year. I'd be hunting primo tags. Because I'd have them point boost me.
Sure, but...
You know, want a bite of the apple? Let's go.
yeah, but I mean, but, how long is that going to... You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, that's always going to happen.
It's a short-lived problem.
But it's not for free. I mean, they're giving up their points.
No.
You know, it's not for
yeah,
free.
Yeah, exactly.
Or...
And something has to be done.
Yeah, or another scenario, right, is Grandpa has been building points for 25 years... You know, loved hunting mule deer back in the day, or maybe he did or didn't. I don't know if he has 25 points. Maybe he's never actually hunted mule deer, but
valid point.
You know, but maybe grandson is a up and coming 12-year-old, and
exactly.
Grandpa would love to ditch his points, you know, to go halvesies with his grandson on a really good unit instead of the best unit in the state or something like that. But he can't. You know, I don't know if there's like mentor programs or tag transfers in Colorado, but
no, there's, well, not to that extent. I mean, it's not like Arizona where, you know, you apply for all of your non-hunting friends and family or family members, and then they transfer tags over to you when they draw them.
Yeah.
We don't have anything like that here, but it's still not. Yeah. I mean, the system's broken. I don't have all the answers to it. In fact, I'm not sure I have any of the answers, but I do feel like that point pooling would help to get those top end guys out of there, because it's unfortunately you cannot. And I guess what would be added with that is a bit more predictability of when you're going to draw, you know, if you, hey, I've got 10 points, I can draw that tag. Well, I've got 10 points, but there's also 3,500 guys who have 25 points.
And you never know when they're going to jump
down
in.
And when they're going to jump into that end of the pool and just, it just changes everything.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a difficult situation and it truly is. And I mean, you know, balance all of that with, like we were talking about earlier, you know, increased better equipment and stuff, but and it's a challenge for the wildlife agencies. I mean, there's no doubt about it. We've got a lot of armchair biologists, which I play
That's
one
me.
From time to time on podcasts, but it, you know, but it's tough. I mean, it truly is. I've been talking to one of the wildlife officers who I've come to know pretty well over the years. She wanted to do a collar study, and I found somebody. So a few months ago, we talked about it, and she's like, yeah, we just need the funding. And I found somebody who would fund it. So I was so excited. I sent her a message the other day and said, hey, I got funding for you. And she goes, okay, cool. Hopefully in the next couple of years, I'll be able to fight through all the red tape within our agency to make that happen. And I mean, talk about just, you know, taking the wind out of your sails, man. I was like, well, that sucked.
The federal government of any kind is a bit, or any government, state or whatever.
Yeah.
They're just such a big, slow moving ship. Yep.
It is. It is. And it takes a long time to, you know, it's like stopping a train. you know, it just doesn't happen quickly.
Yeah.
But
well, I still, you know, to wrap up, I guess I feel like guys like you, guys who are in it, guys who, you know, this is their life. They're not, you know, you're not just, you know, you're not a guy that's just doing it for the Instagram. You're a guy that has been doing this long before and will do it long after. Guys like you will adapt, pivot, you know, figure it out. You'll adjust. You'll find ways to hunt mule deer, whether it's, you know, in Colorado or out, whether it's in a different unit in Colorado or not, or whatever. You'll find a tag, you'll find good bucks in there, and you'll be successful. So
yeah, that's what it, well, you know, you've just got to be willing to adapt. And I mean, I've been forced to adapt before and still come out of it with a deer, and you know, yeah. You just have to want it.
Yep. So. Okay. Well, my takeaways from this are, Henry has a wealth of knowledge on archery and mule deer, and the creature on the Monster Ultra Fiesta is the most fierce pack llama that's ever been created. Did I sum it up pretty well?
Yeah. I think we can definitely agree on the pack llama.
Yeah.
I still feel like I'm a work in progress on trying to figure out how to kill mule deer within the season dates. I mean, you know, if that season was like 45 days long, nah, I'd probably lose my job.
I thought you were implying that you kill them just fine, just out of season poaching them.
No. I can document every date. That's not a problem. But yeah, no, it's, I just wish the seasons were a little longer, you know, that's all. Just always wishing for just a little bit more, which is, you know, kind of the genesis of it. We're all never satisfied with what we have. So yeah.
That's the secret to life, man. You know, it's always going to be the good old days. And so if we can, you know, just be happy with where we're at and, you know, just live life to the fullest and live it, you know, happy to have what you have in your hand at the time, then you'll, be a lot better off, I think.
I agree. Totally agree.
Okay. Well, appreciate it, man.
So Dustin, one question I had for you before we quit.
Uh-oh.
What unit was that again that you shot that buck in last year?
That was the Wasatch Front West in Utah.
Perfect.
Yep.
Perfect. That's what I thought. Okay. I just wanted to confirm that.
Okay, yeah. You got it.
Awesome. All right, Dustin. Good chatting with you.
Yeah. See you, brother.
And take care.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for listening to the Finding Backcountry podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure you subscribe and mention it to your friends. But the best thing you can do, leave a rating on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. For notes and links to this and other episodes, please visit findingbackcountry.com.